Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, good morning. Let's start with a date we'd like to forget.
Absolutely, Bob, and difficult to ever do that for anyone who was in the area at the time and heard this as it came in. This week in 1978, a notorious serial killer was about to be identified and arrested. John Wayne Gacy walked into the police station, was facing questioning in relation to a young man who had disappeared from a local pharmacy. He had visited the pharmacy, and when he spoke with police, he said, didn't talk to the kid, didn't talk to him at all, but I was there. The young man's name was Robert Peast, and of course, all of that was a lie. What Gacy didn't know was that police had already discovered two crucial facts. Other people at the pharmacy heard him talking to the teen, heard him offering him a job as a contract, kind of a light work like that at his house, at Gacy's house, and they knew he was lying. And number two, police had obtained a search warrant and were on their way to his house as they were questioning him. Of course, that's when the horrors were revealed in the crawl space on his property. So many young victims. Gacy always denied it, and said they were making it up about him. Everything was being made up about him. He still claimed his innocence 12 years later when he gave his first interview to Walter Jacobson. And said it was all made up, but Walter did listen in here. Walter does get him to slip up in that interview.
But if you listen carefully, you catch him slipping up about John Vukovic, for instance, his second victim.
What happened to what happened in the Vukovic case? Where was he picked up, and how did he get to the house, and what happened with him?
I don't want to go into the other the five that I know about. Just take it that I didn't. Vukovic is not one that I killed, so I don't know nothing about him. The little bit that I know about him is that he was an employee of my. See, when you look about this recall business. And
I'm not a prosecutor, John, but you just is not one that you killed, which suggests that maybe in fact there were others that you did kill.
I'm sorry if I led you to believe. No, strike it then. That is wrong.
Strike it. Wow. Mm. And they're still working some cold case files on this, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's so many victims they believe that could have been linked to John Wayne Gacy. But in the age when there wasn't DNA evidence and a lot of these young men had kind of run away from home or no one was really looking for them, there have been a lot of efforts. Sheriff Dart has led some of them over the years to not only find more cases, but also link the unidentified victims. And there still are some of those, too, to try to find their families and close those cases once and for all.
Next, Blago. Is this possible? 14 years ago he was arrested?
Doesn't it seem like it was going on forever, Bob? And it kind of was. You remember there were two trials and a lot of reality shows in between. But in 2008, he was holding court this week outside his Northside home. A sea of reporters were there. He was speaking out for the first time since the feds moved in and arrested him. Remember, they gave him a call early in the morning and they said, we're arresting you on corruption charges. We're outside your house. They gave him notice that he thought it was a joke. It wasn't, of course, a joke. But this was his moment. There was this lingering question. What was he going to do about the Senate seat? When you're being charged with selling the Senate seat, now you still have the authority to technically fill that Senate seat. What was he going to do? And that was something reporters certainly asked him that day outside his house.
Look, I can tell you who's not on my short list.
Go ahead. Do you think the cloud that hangs over you is going to taint your pick?
I don't believe there's any cloud that hangs over
you. Well, getting back to that,
I think there's nothing but sunshine hanging over me. Let me answer that. Your question is, and by the way, I should say, if anybody wants to tape my conversations, go right ahead. Feel free to do it. I appreciate anybody who wants to tape me openly and notoriously, and those who feel like they want to sneakily and wear taping devices, I would remind them that it kind of smells like Nixon and water. But I don't care whether you take me privately or publicly. I can tell you that whatever I say is always lawful, and the things I'm interested in doing are always lawful. And if there are any things like that out there, what you'll hear is a governor who tirelessly and endlessly figures out ways to help average, ordinary working people. You might hear a couple of words that you might not hear publicly, but those are only adjectives to describe maybe some of you.
We were hearing
only adjectives, Bob.
It seemed like every...
Essen Golden. Is that an adjective?
I remember every day we heard from him. And lately, it's been kind of quiet on the Blago front, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been. He's sort of been, you know, kind of taking a back seat. And not everyone expected that, but I think he kind of has done that.
Yeah.
You know?
This was a huge week in Chicago history, a big story involving the Chicago Police Department. Anna?
Yeah, Bob. Pivotal moment, painful moment for our city. 2015, that police dashboard video was released of Laquan McDonald being shot 16 times by Officer Jason Van Dyke. Its release was delayed 13 months, I think you'll recall. That's highly unusual. And it was released after his family had been quietly paid a $5 million settlement by the city that included signing a non-disclosure agreement to never talk about anything that happened. You might have thought the whole thing would just get swept under the rug, but what became clear, so clear, when that video was released was that the public had been totally misled by the city, by police, about the facts of the case. And there also appeared to be this enormous cover-up. You know, the sad truth here is that what we all saw on that tape, or most of us saw on that tape, seemed to differ so greatly from the city's account. They had said that Laquan McDonald lunged in the direction of police officers and that they had no choice but to shoot him, and the use of deadly force was justified. That is absolutely not what most people saw, and it's not what a jury saw either. They convicted Jason Van Dyke, of course, of killing Laquan McDonald.
It seems like since then, police departments around the country have been releasing video quicker and making sure that it's all out there for people, don't you think?
You do see that, Bob. It's absolutely true. I think that was the part of it. There was officer misconduct, but then there was the additional crime to so many of us to think that this entire city of public officials in different areas, the mayor's office, the police department, the state's attorney's office, all seemed to keep it under wraps.
Yeah.
That was the second piece of it that was very difficult for people to understand.
Let's talk about some TV history made this week in 1981.
Pat Sajak, a Chicagoan, debuted on Wheel of Fortune 41 years ago. He was a Columbia College grad, Chicago Public Schools grad, too. And, Bob, you'll appreciate this. He won. You probably even know this. I didn't know this. He won a local contest on Dick Biondi's radio show to be a guest teen DJ.
Yeah.
How about that?
I was a loser in that contest, by the way.
Oh, were you in the contest?
I think I entered, but I didn't win. Yeah, they did it. They did it for a while every week on Art Roberts' show or other programs there. But, yeah, Sajak got on. He did.
Well, you both... things turned out well for both of you as it went, but he was able to parlay that into an overnight radio gig before broadcasting in Vietnam for the troops, kind of like Robin Williams' character in Good Morning Vietnam. But he went on to become a TV weatherman, and then Wheel of Fortune came knocking. Merv Griffin himself asked Pat Sajak, he wanted him for the job. So Chuck Woolery, who was hosting it at the time, was stepping aside to work on something else, move on to another project. Pat Sajak took over and held the job for, as we said, four decades, breaking a Guinness Book record for longest-serving game show hosts, surpassing Bob Barker from Price is Right. And we dug up his very first appearance on Wheel of Fortune. Here's how it went.
And now, here's your new host, Pat Sajak.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack Clark. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Wheel of Fortune. Please do not adjust your sets at home. Chuck Woolery has not shrunk. A lot of people are playing with a vertical hold right now. As Jack mentioned, my name is Pat Sajak, and I've been fortunate enough to wander onto the set of a very successful program, has been for a long time. One of the big reasons for that success, of course, was Chuck Woolery. Most of you know by now, Chuck has decided to leave the show to concentrate on other areas in his career. He's a very talented actor and singer and songwriter. So I want to take a minute, and I know everyone in the studio does, and all his fans around the country, to wish Chuck nothing but the best for future success and happiness. Chuck, this is for you.
Interesting. Yeah, Pat was a weatherman for the NBC station out in L.A., and that's how Merv Griffin saw him. And one day, Anna, I'll tell you the story of my ill-fated audition for the job of host of the daytime version of Wheel of Fortune. Yeah,
I totally want to hear that. I want to hear that.
Hopefully we'll have no time for that this morning, though. let's get back to Chicago history and a little comedy history in our city.
Love Tina Fey. I think she's one of the most talented and just lights up the screen and everything she does. Well, she, in 1996, had just graduated to the main stage at Chicago's Second City, and she was getting noticed almost immediately, not only for her comedic presence and what she did improvisationally on stage, but also for her writing and story-building talents. She later became, of course, the first female head writer at SNL, a star on camera and off. And this is an interesting true story. Tina Fey auditioned for Second City a few hours before Amy Poehler.
Hmm.
About that. Both became so close and went on to, you know, such success together and separately, but hosted the Oscars together. One of my favorite choices ever for the Oscars. But here's Tina Fey. We pulled a clip of her talking about her time, reminiscing about how she had the right look to fit in Chicago back in the 90s.
I had studied acting in college and playwriting, and it was not until I started studying improvisation in Chicago that I really felt like I found, oh, this is what makes sense to me. This is the kind of work I want to do. I very much looked like I was from Chicago. I had short hair, kind of curly on top, and I was a size 12, and I, you know, ate a lot of hot dogs and hamburgers, and I was very happy, too. When you're in Chicago and you're an improviser, it is everything to you. It is a complete cult and a church and everything to you, and it, I think, completely shaped the kind of writer I am today and everything about me.
Yes, Second City, also the Improv Olympics, providing cast members to SNL for decades, right?
And she's a hot dog girl, Bob. Good kind of girl.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I liked her. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Anna. This Week in Chicago sure. History. More next Wednesday. Have a good one.
You too.
This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, our Wednesday feature, was just on. And we didn't have time to get to one of the stories Anna had today. I'll share this with you now. John Williams, you'll enjoy this. And it's all about what happened in 1931 in Chicago. This Week in 1931. The city was struggling financially. The schools were a mess. Unemployment and crime were rising. And the city council was focused on whether women should be allowed to wear bikinis on public beaches.
Wow.
1931.
Here in Chicago?
Mm-hmm. The modest swimming costume was still the preferred way to go. But city government was taking a stand on this. On the one hand, you had the minority council members who believed that old Victorian and prudish standards were out of date. In the past, a woman on the beach was required to wear long black stockings, a long sleeve top, and full body coverings, or risk getting arrested for public indecency. Women were invited to give testimonials to the city council on proper swimwear. Huh. Ultimately, the 50 male members of the council would decide what was decent and indecent. Women in backless, sleeveless swimsuits had been sighted on city beaches and received public attention, coverage in the papers, and some tickets for breaking the law. In the end, the council decided in favor of modern swimsuits. They would be allowed, which meant they could move on to more important matters.
I wonder if that was a measure of equity or the old men just wanted to look at the ladies in bikinis.
Well, yeah, I bet on that.
I'll vote for a two-piece.
Yeah.